Good morning. Marie and I have now been here a little over 8 years, which on the one hand doesn't seem like that long, but if you look around, it's so the church is so different than it was 8 years, even 8 years ago. It's incredible how many people have come and how many more young people we have and just the changes that we've seen. And now we keep mentioning that, but it really is amazing, and it's a really great blessing to have, and I really love to see, especially about all of the young kids. We have a lot of young people now, and I love to see them. I mean, the Ericsons moved where they sat to provide location for all of our young people to sit together, and it's truly, truly a wonderful thing. There's a verse that we often direct at our young people in Ecclesiastes, the 12th chapter. You maybe know it. It is Ecclesiastes 12:1. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. It was the thing of summer camp themes when I was a kid. That was at least the theme once or twice while I was a kid at summer camp. But to remember your Creator in the days of your youth. And it's a great message. And that's because we really want you to know and remember and learn to revere God properly in your life whenever you're young. It's really important. It's in the same vein of Proverbs 22 and verse 6. Right? Train a child up in the way he should go, and when he grows old, he will not depart from it. We want you all to become firmly planted and to move forward in your life, revering God always among all things in your life. But I find that I seldom read the rest of that verse. And Ecclesiastes chapter 12, while certainly directed at young people, is actually about another group of people, of which we have a great number in our congregation. And if I can be slightly indelicate, it's the old people. Of course, like that's a pejorative term. You shouldn't say that, right? And so I won't classify you as old or not. I'll leave that to you. You can decide. But I want to suggest and point out that the thrust of this work, this verse, these verses here, is really a poem, and it's a poem about growing old. Let's read it together. Ecclesiastes 12. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come, and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened, and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent, and the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows are dimmed, and the doors on the street are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low, and one rises up at the sound of the bird, and all the daughters of the song are brought low. They are afraid of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails, because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. It's kind of bleak and kind of a dark kind of moment. And yet, the speaker here tells us to remember the Creator in the days of our youth. And the reason is because these are the dark days that are coming. And we have many in our congregation who these days are even upon them now. And I don't understand all the imagery in that. You may have been reading through that and not quite got all of that either. But it definitely paints a picture of a darkening, of a loss of desire, of a fading. The things that you love doing today and that you fill your life with joy, the sun will set on those things. And there will be a time whenever you can't do those things anymore. And so the writer here is talking specifically to young people, to all of us really, to realize that such days will come. And therefore, right now, firm up in your mind who is your Creator, because you're going to need him, and you are going to need to be strong for when those moments come in your life. I wanted for a long time to teach a lesson to give honor to our older people and what they're going through. A lot of what some of them are going through is maybe known to us because They're the things of our prayer list. They come up a lot of times. We know things about some of them. We know about, for example, Larry's fight with cancer. It's great to see Larry today. Or Shirley's fight with MS. We don't see Shirley today. There's a great many others that are struggling, and you might not even know what it is, with diagnoses that are really, really terrible. And so, in some way, I wanted to teach this lesson, not so much because I have anything to offer you, but because I want you to know that we see you, and we think about you, and we appreciate the lesson that you're teaching us. And so I'd like for us for a moment today to reflect and think upon the teaching that we find here in the book of Ecclesiastes. The book of Ecclesiastes, it's a weird name. I'm one of those guys that really likes to know, why in the world is this thing called that? I'm pretty sure you've never heard the word Ecclesiastes used in regular conversation. And that's because it is a Greek transliteration of a Hebrew word. And you might see in that the word ekklesia, which if you're a New Testament Bible student, may make you think of church. That's the word that we translate in the New Testament as church. It really means assembly, right? That's what an ecclesia was. Ecclesiastes is a different form of that word. It's not an assembly. It's the assembler. It's the person who calls together an assembly to happen. If you go to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1, your translation may render it a little differently, but it should say the words of the preacher. That word preacher there in the Hebrew is a word koheleth, and in Greek it is Ecclesiastes, which is what this book is. And so the whole name of the book, it really paints this picture about this speaker who has called you all here together, and now we're going to listen to what this speaker has to say. The book finds itself in the wisdom literature. So you lump it all together with Job, Psalms, Proverbs. All of these books go together in the ancient Jewish writings. And it's very much of the same flavor as the book of Proverbs. It's meant to impart to you some wisdom. Of course, that wisdom takes a much different flavor than it does in the book of Proverbs. Do you ever feel like Proverbs is just way too positive? You know, like, it's very optimistic, almost annoyingly so. You know, it's like, well, if you listen to my words, and if you treasure them, and if you really pursue wisdom, and you really go after it with all you've got, it's going to go well with you. Your life is going to be long, and things are just going to be great. I mean, it kind of paints this rose-tinted picture. And we understand that Proverbs is not, it's not a formula. It's not like you do this, and this is going to be fine. But rather, it's trying to teach us how to avoid the sticky kinds of problems that we find in our lives. Ecclesiastes is very different. It's very cynical. It looks at life, and he realizes that you can work really hard for things. You can dedicate your life to gaining wisdom and knowledge. You can pursue all sorts of pleasures and parties and try to fill it with a great number of things, but your time comes, right? And the rich man suffers the same fate as the poor man, as the wise man, and as the fool. And so he kind of points out these different kinds of what he calls vanities, or what's translated for us as vanities. And we'll just read a couple of moments here of the book. It's not really meant to be depressing. Some people kind of get a depressing feel. It's not meant to be depressing. It's meant to be sobering. So let's see a little bit of the wisdom that he has to offer in chapter 3. We'll try to emphasize a couple of his take-home points here. Of course, the beginning of chapter 3 are the words to that famous song by the Birds. And if you know that song, then this sermon might be for you. That's back in the 60s, everybody. Full disclosure, that was before my time, but I know the song. the words are the words from the first part of Ecclesiastes chapter 3. But I want to start reading at verse 9. The speaker reflects to us, what gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen this business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he's put eternity into man's heart so that it cannot find out what God has done from the beginning into the end. He looks out, he sees that man has been given this thing to occupy himself with, and it becomes beautiful in his time. Not like in your time. Right? Like it to become beautiful. I want it beautiful when I want it to work out, right? But no, it doesn't work like that, does it? It becomes beautiful in his time, which incidentally is the inspiration for the hymn we often sing, in his time. Right? It's up to him. And the scripture also teaches us that God has actually put eternity into our hearts. I don't know exactly what that means, but he tells us that he's put something in there that we're always going to strive to look to understand, and we're never quite going to get it. That's in there by design. And that can be very frustrating, and that can be very disquieting. But look what he says to do about it in verse 12. I perceive, therefore, that there is nothing better for them but to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. And also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all of his toil, for this is God's gift to man. His conclusion, and this is something that comes back at several moments in the piece, is that we are supposed to appreciate the blessings that are all around us, to take joy in the good things that are around, because life is going to be full of good and bad. And therefore, when the good comes, to take hold of it, enjoy it, and appreciate it. And this is a theme that he revisits in chapter 6 as well, which is perhaps my favorite image in the entire book. He paints the picture of two hypothetical men. Right? They're not real people. He says there in chapter 6 and verse 1, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, honor, so he lacks nothing of all he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity, and it is a grievous evil. Can you imagine? What a ridiculous setting. God has blessed this man. He's given him everything in the world he ever wanted, right? All fill in the blanks, right? For me, it's bicycles. I know Gene wants a motorcycle. Right? There's, you know, you could fill it in, maybe tools. I don't know what you do. Imagine you had everything in the world that you ever wanted, right? And it's there in all sorts of honor and glory. But one thing you don't have is the ability to enjoy it. You just kind of have it sitting all in your house, but you're not happy. You're just like some grumpy person just sitting around, and you're not happy with any of that. But somebody you don't even know gets to come into the house and enjoy all of those things. That would be silly and pointless, wouldn't it? He paints another picture. If a man fathers 100 children, first of all, that doesn't sound like fun at all. But and he talks about the man too, not the woman. But if a man fathers 100 children, I mean, it's to say that his life is incredibly blessed, right? That he's been so productive. He lives many years, so the days of his years are many, and his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and also has no burial, I say a stillborn child is better off than he. If you have this rich life, blessed with family and honor, and things are all around you, and you're not able to appreciate the good things that are around you, it would have been better that you died in childbirth. Right? And his point is a good one. Right? God blesses us with the things he blesses us because he wants us to enjoy. He wants those things to make us happy, and if we don't let them make us happy, then we've missed the point entirely of that blessing. And I think that's a truth that the author here of Ecclesiastes finds that really has profoundly affected me. And so that's a bit of the teaching of the book of Ecclesiastes. Of course, that's by no means all of it. But when I was trying to think of what I might say to try to encourage a bit some of our older members and thinking specifically in the struggles that they have, the verse that came to mind is what I had my dad read for us today in chapter 7. Let's read that again. Ecclesiastes 7, starting in the first verse. He writes there that a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. Now think about that a second. I've been to some births before, not like the actual birth, but in the waiting room, like outside. And man, it's wonderful. First of all, you know, you're up at a weird time of the day because a baby's not going to come on your schedule. It's going to come, you know, whenever it pleases, right? Whenever it's time to come. It's so neat to be there at the hospital. The family's all gathered together. It's exciting. Everybody is apprehensive of the new life that's about to come. It's truly a wonderful thing. And yet the author says that really the day of death is better than the day of one's birth. He goes on to say, it's better to go to the house of mourning than it is to go to the house of feasting. Now, I don't use those phrases very much, house of mourning and house of feasting. So let's say it a different way. It's better to go to a funeral than it is to go to a birthday party. Now, I'm not big on birthday parties, but I would much rather go to a birthday party. So what's he saying? What does it mean? Does it mean we shouldn't have these types of festivals and partings and things like that? No. Let's see what he really means by it. He says, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. He wants us to go there because he wants us to reflect. Because those moments, the house of mourning, the griefs that we bear, the things that truly make us sad, is the end of us all if we're blessed enough to make it that far. And it teaches us a lesson. And the author wants us to have our ears open to what that lesson is. He goes on, that sorrow is better than laughter. For by sadness of the face, the heart is made glad. Right? Which always seemed kind of like a paradox to me. He said that sorrow is better than laughter, but the point of sorrow is to make you glad. But that's the point, right? The point is that by truly grieving and by learning those lessons, by reflecting on our mortality, it helps teach us lessons about the kind of people that we want to be and the kind of directions that we want to go. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It's better for a man to hear a rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This is also vanity. I don't know if you've ever tried to cook anything on an open fire, like out camping or something before. But it's challenging. When you build that fire, you're for sure that fire is hot enough to cook your eggs. And sure enough, you run out of fire long before. If you really want to cook over an open fire, you've got to have a fire roaring for quite some time before you have enough coals to really do anything. If you just grab the weeds, right, grab the thorns, the little twigs, and stick them under your fire, they're going to crackle and they're going to make a loud sound, like the scripture is talking about here. But you're by no means going to have enough heat, really, to do anything with. And that's what he's comparing here this to, right? About true growth and reflection comes, you know, by enduring these moments, these hard moments in our lives. And the reader urges us to embrace them. And so when I think really about particularly our aging population and the challenges and struggles that they're going through, it makes me as a younger person really want to communicate to them that I have my eyes open and I'm watching and I want to know more about those things and those struggles that you go through. And that you are still teaching us a lot by your example and that you show us in this life. Of course, here the author wants us to go to the house of mourning to learn those lessons because wisdom is found there. It does us some good. But we as Christians really are urged to be compassionate even for not our own benefit, right? We are also instructed to learn to be compassionate to others as part of our Christian walk. And one verse that comes to my mind is in Matthew, the 9th chapter. Jesus himself was full of compassion. We should also take note of and think about and pray for and listen to our aging members and the things that they're going through because we feel compassion for them as well. And one of the this is one of many verses like this in the 9th chapter, verse 35. It talks about Jesus going throughout all the other villages. He was teaching to them. And in verse 36, it says, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Think that's just one of the many moments that we read about where Jesus looked around, surveyed the scene around him, and took note of the people that were suffering, that were distressed. And it's really not so hard to find people who are distressed and suffering if you open your eyes and are looking for it. And we, like our Savior, need to have that same heart of compassion, of looking for those people whom we can help. It's not the only place that we find it. Of course, it's littered throughout the Gospels and the example of Jesus. It's also all the way throughout the rest of the New Testament. One verse that quickly comes to mind is in Romans chapter 12. And in Romans chapter 12, the Apostle Paul is writing, and he tells us quite simply in verse 15, to rejoice with those who rejoice, and to weep with those who weep. At least there's a fun side to this one, right? Okay, people who are happy, we're right there with them. We're to rejoice with them. But we are also supposed to mourn and weep and with those who are mourning and weeping as well. In 2 Corinthians, in Paul's introduction to this letter, in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, he writes about being comforted. And there he says, "Blessed be the God and the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the Father of mercies and God of all comfort." He describes God as a God of mercy, but also the God of all comfort. He is the one that really provides us comfort in this life. And when you're ailing, and when things are very hard, and when the days are dark, this is what we aim for. This is what we strive for. We want this comfort. Verse 4, though, he comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. That's a lot of appearances of the word comfort in one sentence. My English teacher would have been all over me, like, no, use a different word. But it really makes the point, doesn't it? The whole point of the reason why you yourself are comforted by God is to comfort you, but it's also so that you have something to turn around and comfort other people with. And that certainly applies to our members here, but also points to the entire world. And so, I don't really know, like I said, it's a lesson that I wanted to teach, not because I know what to say, but it's a lesson that I wanted to teach, first of all, to honor our aging members, and also to point out to us, you know, that there are a population of our group that needs our support too. And the one verse that really comes to mind that I leave you with, that I have found is always a great strength whenever I find myself injured or stretched thin, is later in 2 Corinthians, the 4th chapter. You'll remember that Paul himself suffers quite a bit. He suffers a lot of persecutions, a lot of physical problems that he had. We know he had a thorn in the flesh of his own. We know that he himself was beaten many times. And to that, he writes here to the Corinthians in chapter 4 and starting verse 16. And he says, "So we do not lose heart." I'm kind of catching you in the middle of the statement, but he starts off by saying, we don't lose heart. We don't get discouraged. "Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day." Paul was focused on not this external suffering that he had no control over. He was focused on the inner man and making sure that he was becoming renewed and strengthened, that spirit becomes stronger and stronger every single day. He says, "For this light momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal." And so the call for all of us, and especially our aging members, is to focus on that which is unseen and which is eternal, and not on this transient, crude flesh, which tragically does not last forever, but on our eternal home, when our spirit goes back to the place from which it came. I hope you found something in that encouraging, hopefully not too depressing. We're going for sobering. And I pray that especially those who are really struggling with life's great issues, that we can become an encouragement to you. We always offer an invitation to those who are not Christians. If you are not yet baptized, we encourage you to think about that heavily, and that should weigh on your conscience. And if you are a Christian but you need prayers, we want to help you too. If we can help you at all in any way, come forward while we stand and sing.